Well, howdy, folks, and welcome to another episode of the Texas Titans podcast. It is, as I record this, it is February 8th in Tyler, Texas. It might be one of the single most gorgeous days we have ever had. So wherever you're listening, I hope it is even a fraction as gorgeous as it is here today. I've got a great show for you. I got to sit down with a true leader and a guy that is just so accomplished at a relatively young age and just has wicked smarts, has a good heart, and has a great story. And even though this conversation was a little more compressed than most of the normal conversations I bring you, we squeezed a lot in. So I think you're really going to learn a lot about Edward Crawford, who, and by the way, you can learn more about Edward if you go out to the YouTubes and look for his TED Talk on servant leadership. So I think if you just did a search on Ed Crawford, servant leader, you'd probably find it. It is fantastic. And so I highly recommend that you go check that out. But I want to give you a little bit of his background before we get started. Edward Crawford is the co-founder and president of Coltala. I want to make sure I'm pronouncing that right. It's Coltala, C-O-L-T-A-L-A Holdings, which is a private equity firm headquartered in Fort Worth. He is the co-founder and president of that company. He has over 15 years of experience in investing, asset management, and building operating teams. As a managing director of Avesta Holdings, Mr. Crawford led business development activities, identified capital and acquisitions, special situation opportunities, and managed key investor relationships. Mr. Crawford helped build Avesta's business to include over 320 employees and $1 billion in assets and $100 million in revenue. Mr. Crawford was a vice president at Goldman Sachs, where he spent 7 years as an advisor to numerous CEOs, institutions, and private company owners. Mr. Crawford joined Goldman Sachs from the private equity firm Advantage Capital Partners, ACP, a national lower middle market private equity firm. Prior to joining ACP, he served as a Peace Corps volunteer in the Dominican Republic, where at 23 years of age, he founded a four-member coffee cooperative and grew it to include more than 200 coffee farmers with access to global markets. Mr. Crawford is a trustee of the New World Symphony in Miami Beach, Florida, a trustee on the Business School Council at the Freeman School of Business at Tulane University in New Orleans, Louisiana, and a term member of the Council on Foreign Relations. As a U.S. Naval Intelligence Officer, Mr. Crawford served with Special Operations Command South in Latin America. From 2012 to 2013, he was deployed to Afghanistan as the tribal and political advisor for SEAL Teams 2 and 4 as part of a Special Operations Task Force. He was awarded the Bronze Star for his service. His education includes an MBA from MIT's Sloan School of Management, an MA GMBA from Tulane University, Latin America Studies and Finance, and a BA from Texas Christian University in English and Literature. That's a mouthful. And I think you're going to really enjoy this conversation. I know I enjoyed getting to know Edward better through this process and through the conversation. And I really think you're going to take some great nuggets of wisdom and insight from him through this. So please listen. And as always, thank you so much for listening to the Texas Titans podcast. And without further ado, I give you Edward Crawford. Thanks, folks.
Okay, so I think we've got a good mic check.
Awesome. You know,
so, Ed, I think we're ready to roll. So here we are on another episode of the Texas Titans podcast. And I am with Ed Crawford. And, man, I'm excited about this because of what we've talked about with regard to the subject at hand, which I really want to focus in on because I know it's your wheelhouse, mm-hmm. Based on your TED Talk, which is where I probably did that's where I've got the greatest amount of research other than that and our mutual friend, Luke. So I want to talk a lot about servant leadership, and then I just want to find out your ideas, your thoughts on leadership and some of those things. So, and I know we're pressed for time. I want to get you out of here because then we've got a very important appointment after this. But first and foremost, brother, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me. Really appreciate it.
Absolutely, yeah. Man. So here's where I want to dive in on this thing. Let's talk about the coffee business. I want to know how that happened because, see, I feel like I've kind of won the lottery with this conversation because I get to talk about three of my favorite things, coffee, servant leadership, and business. So, I mean, you know, you kind of cover that whole spectrum,
yeah.
Man. So let's talk coffee, man. How did that start? And then I want to tease out some of the lessons learned from that experience.
For sure, for sure. So it actually started, it started with a failure, frankly. So I was positioned with a group in the Dominican that the Peace Corps had set me up with. And they had a couple of projects where they'd been given money to execute on these projects. And they ended up selling, one of them was a forestry project, the other one's a chicken project. They ended up selling the chicken, frying the chicken, and selling it to get money quicker rather than selling the eggs, which are supposed to be a sustainable project. Mm. I recommended against that. And eventually I said, guys, I'm not going to work with you anymore. And I went to my $12 a month tin shack, sat in there and said, what am I going to do with the next 27 months of my life? Okay. And so it was a big wake up moment. And that's when I had done some research. I did a tour of the community and interviewed over 300 families. Okay. And put together a survey. And the things I found were that a lot of people used to grow coffee. You can grow coffee throughout the year, half the year. And so basically October all the way through January, it's really producing. Mm-hmm. And in May, you can grow mangoes in it. You can have avocados come out in October. Mm-hmm. And so you have kind of agroforestry, but a diversified set of things that they can grow in it.
I love it.
And it also helps protect the rainforest because most of the area in Haiti had been deforested by just migrant farmers.
Wow.
So you cut down the forest, you plant yucca or you plant corn on these slopes. Sun touches the dirt once you harvest, and the dirt rolls off the mountain, never to return, turns into rock and desert.
Wow.
So it was accomplishing two goals. It was the ability to kind of keep the forest there so that they would have that. Mm-hmm. And secondly, really produce income for their families more sustainably. And so there was three pillars, right? Get a microfinance rotating fund for a group of coffee farmers to organize them so that they could have microfinance rotating funds so they would get lending at a better rate.
Yep.
They could get organic certified, too. Yeah. And three, they could sell directly instead of through the intermediary. So this is what kind of started the idea. And I rode around on a horse with a machete asking people to come to my meetings. And it took them a while, and I had to learn a lot before eventually got people to come. But eventually we pulled it together. So
wow. Now, have you ever heard of Thrive Farmers? So they supply all of Chick-fil-A's coffee.
Wow.
Exact same model. Mm-hmm. One of my closest friends, a guy named Colin Barbado, he spent some time there as their COO when they were coming out of the, I think they were out of the mezzanine round.
Okay.
It was same thing, private equity backed. Some VC guys had come in and funded them. Very similar. So anyway, yeah. I was just curious. So,
very
all
cool.
Right. And so take me through some of the lessons learned during that, because I know you, it was a pretty challenging time physically, not just mentally and not just, emotionally, but physically it became pretty challenging, right?
Yeah. So I think, part of it was pride, right? Mm-hmm. I had to swallow the pride. And I think I stumbled into servant leadership, not because I wanted to, but because I ended up having to, right? Mm-hmm. So, because the first project failed, and then I went around trying to rally the troops to get a group together, and that wasn't working out, I just did what the Peace Corps taught me to do, and it was have coffee with the people and serve. Mm-hmm. And so I just started working with them, working my butt off, and that's when I ultimately got sick. I got maybe dysentery, ended up with dengue fever as well, lost a bunch of weight, felt miserable, and sitting in my shack just feeling terrible, and I had everything from a witch doctor that put crushed up bones on my head to people offering me free injections with syringes I didn't know where they had been from,
right.
To some little old ladies rubbing Vicks Vapor Rub on me.
Right.
So it was, people were all trying to help me, and I was there to help them, and so it was very humbling. I doubted myself as a leader, doubted as a Peace Corps volunteer, what was I really doing to help, and felt pretty lonely, sad, and weak. And it was at that point when the community said, hey, this guy has given up so much to help us. He sacrificed his own health to help us. Maybe we should trust him.
Yeah.
And that was the point when I hit bottom and I was truly broken and I couldn't help anybody. Mm-hmm. And my pride was completely gone at that point, that they were open to me and we were able to kind of have a conversation that ultimately started the coffee business. And
wow.
It was just a few short months later, we had 200 something people under a mango tree doing our first election, and then we kind of grew from there. So
wow. Let's talk a little bit about, and by the way, so there'll be a full bio of you in the show notes, and I'll do an intro, so that's why we don't waste time with some of those details, but you're a deal maker. I mean, that's what you do. And you touched on something you're in a foreign land, and you realize the value of connecting with the people that are involved. And, you know, we kind of talked about it just from the elevator in here that, you know, it's relationships and understanding and reputation that get so many deals done. Mm-hmm. Would you agree? I mean, I know that I can tell you the company I was telling you about, the first one that I ever purchased, it was literally a 56-year-old firm where it was two generations, actually three generations in the business at the time. And so they're looking for their exit. So who they sold to was almost as important as just selling in general. So talk a little bit about, as you're developing through this process, the Peace Corps, the coffee business, and developing an understanding of what relationships mean to getting deals done and showing the care and the willingness to invest in people to get them to come around to at least getting to the table and getting deals done.
Yeah, 100%. I would say, you know, you've got different types of private equity. You've got these huge businesses. You've got the middle market. Where we sit in the lower middle market, relationships really matter, right? I was with a Boston private equity firm the other day, and their hiring processes, they screen for people who are nice people, right? Because they're dealing with CEOs from different, maybe a small town, medium-sized town, but they have to relate to people and really understand them. It's not how smart or how capable they are, but really that relationship piece.
Right.
And so I'll give you a good example on a transaction that we recently did. So we backed a CEO named Paul Adams, who was formerly with Service Experts, and his team, he and Eric Shaw are the leadership. And we looked for businesses to buy here in DFW, right? Okay. And Paul is very much a servant leader, relationship guy, and builds trust very easily. Many of the sellers told us, we will only sell our business to you. Mm-hmm. These are HVAC services, air conditioning, residential.
Yep.
We'll only sell our businesses to you if you can take better care of our people than we can.
Yeah.
Right? And that hit us very hard. It wasn't about the money. It's important. But at the end of the day, they had techs, they had employees, and they wanted to keep them and they want to take care of them.
Right. Right?
Paul, over a 12-month period, showed them that he cared about their people, demonstrated that he would go above and beyond to take care of them and their people and help them, even if it wasn't helpful to him, right? True servant leadership. And on June 2nd, we had two businesses sell. Mm-hmm. One was a 57-year-old business in Dallas, and the other was in Arlington, and it was 30, 35-year-old business, right?
Yeah.
And we have another one in the works. All of them were multi-generational, that were family businesses that had sons or daughters in the business. Mm-hmm. And when they handed this over to Paul and team, it was evident that they were handing over their baby.
Right.
One of the couples even, you know, cried a little and hugged Paul, and I think they think of Paul as a son. So it's an example of how servant leadership really plays true in business, and I think Paul Adams was a great example of that.
Right.
In private equity, right? But it was relationships, it was trust. He was an industry person and somebody that they could trust. And that, I think that'll help us in the business. We have largely kept all the employees so far because they believe in Paul and his team and that he truly cares about them.
Right. Well, you know, it's interesting to me, Ed, that, you know, there's two, and just for the listener, and just so you know, like, I mean, this audience is a very entrepreneurial audience for the most part, either people that want to be entrepreneurs or entrepreneurs. I also think there's a lot of established business people out there who may be planning an exit or are in a job and think they want to get out and start a business. So I like to dig into some of these aspects of entrepreneurship. And, you know, with PE, you've got, you know, the churn and burn class. It's go in, acquire, right, maximize efficiencies and get ready to put back on the selling block for, you know, a 10x return, get out and go do the next deal. Then you've got another model that I think Berkshire Hathaway has proven works pretty well too, which is go find a good firm with good DNA, good leadership, and don't screw it up.
Right.
Yes, offer some more efficiencies through technology and maybe some back-end administrative cross-pollination, whatever the case may be. When you guys go into a firm and knowing that there's history involved and that the continuity of the culture and from the founders and multiple generations through, where do you start? And I'm asking for selfish reasons too, because, you know, I've got my own ideas, but I'm always looking for more. I actually just started an advisory project for a very similar firm. It's a 40-year-old firm, has multiple generations involved, great, great company, very well run. It's it's really, really, and they're not looking for an exit or anything. I've come in just to kind of help them define their culture. I mean, yeah. You've been there for 40 years. Let's put to paper what you have. So what do you guys do whenever you go into one of these deals?
Yeah, well, you know, I think anybody, myself included, you can get myopic in your own industry and vertical, right? Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. you run your business and you talk to the industry, peers, but you can get myopic. And so one of the things we look for is growth-oriented people. Right? Yeah. Coachable, growth-oriented people that are leading the businesses, who want to lead the businesses, right? And so with the example of our Trudella team, right, we're doing, we have a thing called the Catala Enterprise System, right? We have some former Danaher alums that work with us on that system.
Okay.
And really, it's, you know, I think some private equity firms, they sit in the board meeting and kind of, hey, this is what you need to do. And in this case, we're not the hero here. The CEO and the management team, they are the hero. We are the support.
Right.
We are there to serve them. We are there to help them train, equip, mentor. And so that's what we do through both ourselves and our network, mm-hmm. and also through Damon Baker and his network. And we go in, we do simple things, walk through their process, mm-hmm. put their entire sales process on a wall.
Right.
Look at how they price things, right? Look at how they recruit. Mm-hmm. Are they recruiting the best ways? Look at their sales process and try to have the best sales process. So very process oriented, and it works in any business. And as long as the management team is open to that in any business, then it works really well. And what we found is the people that are largely attracted to us are people that want that continuous improvement culture. So they're always trying to get just a little bit better.
Yep.
It's an incrementalism approach.
Yep.
It's that person that wakes up every day, does a gratitude practice, that wakes up every day and says, I'm going to get a little bit better. I'm going to read. I'm going to take that extra course.
Yep.
I'm going to go to some night school. I'm going to watch some podcasts because I want to always be improving.
Right.
And when we find those growth-oriented leaders, they're attracted to what we have to offer, mm-hmm. and we can grow together.
Okay.
So that's kind of how we work.
Oh, fantastic. All right, so now I'm going to take you back a little bit. There is no chronological order to my
service. And by the way, it starts with people, plan, process, performance. That's kind of how we walk through.
I love that.
The people build businesses is one of our mottos, along with mission and margin.
Yeah.
And so it always starts with the people, and that's our core.
Well, your human capital, man, is the most valuable asset, yep. right, of any deal. So now let's take it back a little bit, because I got to think, you know, what I know about you, McKinney, you've got wicked smarts, you know. I mean, you're an MIT guy, so you understand the technical components of doing the deals, evaluating valuation, that sort of thing. But also early on, there was this servant leadership in your DNA. So talk to me about that. How does one decide to, first of all, I guess your first, and maybe I want to know, and you correct me, I want to learn from this. How do you end up in the Peace Corps?
Yeah.
You know, and where does that come from, and what was the mindset that led you there? And just kind of walk me through where this took hold in you.
Yeah. Well, you know, first of all, both my parents are humble servant leaders. My mom runs a Suzuki violin program in Shreveport, Louisiana, has graduated over 2,000 students, and her mission every day is to get up and give kids from all over Shreveport, Louisiana area an opportunity to maybe get a scholarship for school. She's given them scholarships herself to her program to get them up, and so just really cares about others. My father's the same way, just a community leader. My grandfather on my mom's side was Jewish and escaped from the Holocaust in 1938. Wow. Wow. And so he's been a big influence in my life. He tried to apply to the U.S. military twice as an Austrian and was rejected, ultimately making it to the U.S., and you know, third time's a charm.
Right.
Once he was here and had his citizenship, he got in. But you know, I understood what he said. He had a thick Austrian accent, kind of Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Right.
Very tough guy. But he eventually forgave Hitler, became a Christian, married my grandmother, who was from Pontotoc, Mississippi. Just incredible story.
Wow.
And brought a cello over from Austria. He smuggled some instruments over. My mom plays the violin he brought over.
Wow.
And my brother plays the 200-year-old cello he brought over. My brother graduated from Juilliard and has played it in the Louvre, has played it in Paris, has played it in the Tchaikovsky competition in Moscow.
Wow.
Carnegie Hall. He just won the Carlos Prieto International Cello Competition, internationally the best cellist in the world through that. And all with my grandfather's cello. So seeing this story and his kind of servant leadership has always inspired me. And I sat, it was with the Memphis Symphony a few months ago with my 99-year-old grandmother.
Wow.
Watching my grandfather's past, but watching my brother play that cello.
Oh,
and so
amazing.
His story and what an amazing country this was that offered him another opportunity. You know, he had lost everything in life, and instead of being angry and bitter, he forgave and chose to serve.
Wow.
And he ended up being the head anesthesiologist at a VA hospital in Memphis, and he was helping these veterans who helped liberate his people. And it was just a really beautiful thing. And so when I was going through college, I was kind of a little aimless. I'm like, I wanted to go into the military in high school.
Okay.
And so going through college, I'm like, what am I going to do? I got to do something that's more meaningful than this.
Right.
And so I literally looked at, you know, Marine, you know, ODA, do I want to go into the Jesuit Corps, Peace Corps? I just looked at all the different options, and I thought Peace Corps is a great way to serve your country, but also to live with those who are impoverished,
yeah,
understand how they feel. And I think there's something beautiful about understanding people at that level in a different country, and then humbling myself to live with them for 2 years,
yeah,
at their level. And so, yeah, that's one of the reasons I wanted to do it, is to serve through faith, to serve others, and then also really our country,
yeah,
in a way, through an organization like the Peace Corps.
You know, and one of the things you touch on there is, and so my first mission trip was a 2-week hiking through the Himalayas to drop off cassettes, mm-hmm, of the gospel in, mm-hmm, these little bitty farms that are on the sides of mountains in the lower Hunan province of China. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there's nothing. You will hike literally straight up,
yeah,
for hours and hours to find a little one-room shack with no running water, no electricity, and that is their quote-unquote farm. And one of the things that that experience taught me was, and by the way, whenever you would walk upon one of these shacks, they always had like a guard dog that would bark, and inevitably the Chinese nationals that had the farm, you can't say owned it, but that managed the farm, right, they would throw a rock to shut the dog up and then welcome you in to their farm and want to give you gifts and feed you and everything. Yeah. And one of the things I took back, and again, this is not, I don't want to be that apologist for all that we have in America and the, mm-hmm, comforts of this incredible nation. Mm-hmm. But I do want people to understand that if you ever want to truly appreciate a cold glass of water, a, yeah, shower, right?
Yeah.
Go spend some time serving in a foreign land where literally just a glass of ice water is the most amazing luxury that you can imagine. That's what that trip taught me. I mean, I kind of like you, I didn't lose 40 pounds on like you did on your deal. I lost 15 because I completely dehydrated.
Yeah.
And I didn't think I was coming back. I was, yeah, fresh. I thought I had failed. I was a father on the other side of the world, and I'm like, you know, the Apostle Paul was awesome and all, but he didn't have children, you,
yeah,
know?
Yeah.
And so you think all these things. And so so that's why whenever, you know, that's a long story about me and this about you for another day. But it's just, I just think what you're talking about with regard to seeing how other cultures and people live is so invaluable. So,
yeah,
so take me through that experience. As how did that continue to shape you while you were in the Peace Corps?
Yeah, well, you know, I'll remember when I got sick, it was, you know, I had to catch water off my roof. And so I had a barrel, mm-hmm, and, mm-hmm, I would catch the water. I had a little kind of filter screen that so it wouldn't get leaves in it.
Right.
And then I threw a little Clorox bleach in it, and I was good to go, right? And that was my water system, right? As long as it was raining, that was my water, right, system. When it didn't rain, I was in a little bit of trouble. But I'll never forget, there was also a drainage canal that Balaguer, one of the older presidents, had built through the south near, mm-hmm, Haiti, where I lived, in Dominican. And, you know, we had seen a dead body in there, you know, dead dog a few weeks ago. And I would clean, I would cook for the children of the community that were poor street kids in the, yeah, community. Yeah. And the deal was I would cook food for them, and then they would clean it.
Right.
We had a kind of a good arrangement. And I'll never forget that day. We had cooked some food, and they had were cleaning it, and one of the little boys brought me back a cup. I'd put some coffee or water or something in it, was drinking it. And then I looked over, and I saw the kids coming from the canal. And I said, oye, pero qué estás haciendo? What are you guys doing, right? And they said, ay, pero estamos lavando en el canal. We're washing in the canal. I realized that my water was out.
Oh, wow.
And they had been washing all the stuff in the canal, and I was now drinking it. It was 2 days later,
oh, no,
when it was over for me. And talk about dehydration, but but dysentery will get you fast.
Yeah.
And so I had a water related.
Oh my!
You got to watch what you drink. So
yeah, absolutely.
You know. But it was, you know, some of the kids I worked with were very sick. I sent the little boy who handed me that cup, his name was Zombie, because he looked like a zombie. That's what people called him. He was so emaciated and skinny. He would dance in the street for, you know, a peso or two and try to get food. He'd just start cleaning your porch so that somebody would give him food.
Right.
He would be sleeping on my floor when I'd wake up some days. I would take him around with me.
Right.
His name is Joseline, and Joseline is in college now, and I've been supporting him to go to college. But he was the one that brought me that water.
Right.
And so it was amazing to watch these kids. I would get sick with the kids because I would be around them, but I couldn't help it.
Wow.
You know, it's just, kids and children were a huge part of the Peace Corps for me.
Well, and I don't know if it was, remind me again exactly where you were.
I was in Dominican Republic in an area called Los Blancos,
right.
Barahona, which is the southern province up against the border of Haiti.
Okay. And so I would imagine that in that instance, as is the case with most very, very poverty, you know, stricken places like that, the children are kind of left to their own devices, right? To kind of roam and like a stranger comes into the village.
Yeah.
Right. So
all the children came to me. It was one of those,
exactly.
It was one of those things. And kids can go to school, but if there's any learning disability, you know, think about 15% of the U.S. has dyslexia or ADHD or autism. Like if you have any of those things.
Yeah. You're done.
You're done.
Yep.
Five-year-old kindergarten, you never learn how to read or anything.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So that was one of the things I loved most. We had to stay in this hostel in this little village of maybe 100 people. And it was the same thing. It was an overnight stay. We weren't supposed to be there, but had to stay. And same thing, man. We spent the whole night teaching the kids like little tricks to do with their strings, and you know, and it was so fun. But you know, the parents are like, "Hey, if you guys want to take the kids, and you can't help but be around them." It was awesome. All right, so now let's get into, because even though you have this incredible understanding of the value of servant leadership, which in and of itself shows that you've got a great sense of humility in your DNA. We talked about this earlier, that you end up at MIT and you end up pursuing, like most of us do, you know, you and I share that. Now, where did you do your undergrad?
TCU.
Okay, so you're...
TCU, Tulane, and MIT are the three schools.
Okay. So we talked about how, like, you know, I ended up going to get an MBA at SMU, which, and I love SMU, love my fellow Mustangs, but for me, that was as I look back now, was purely an exercise in vanity, more than anything. It was me trying to prove, hey, you need to take me seriously, not because of the fruits of my labor, but because, look, I have an MBA from SMU, so I must be smart, so listen to me, which was absolutely stupid, right? So... talk to me about how you take from Peace Corps to your first endeavors into MIT and then Goldman. Kind of walk me through that and some of the challenges that you philosophically or however that you faced during that time.
Yeah, I'd say at Goldman, wanted to be at a place that was very competitive with smart people where I could really learn. Mm-hmm. And so enjoyed my experience there. It was a very strong culture, but I woke up. This was when I decided to deploy. I was actually in the military in the reserves, but I got a call that would change my life about a friend. We had gone to high school together in middle school, and I heard that he had been killed. And then I knew another close friend of ours in high school. I knew they had gone. They were actually both in the Navy, and tried to get a hold of him. You know, hadn't talked to him in years. And turns out he was on the same helicopter, and they had both been killed.
Wow.
And so I sat and I went back to Shreveport, Louisiana. I ended up running into my friend Rob's fiance on the plane there, and she was in difficult shape for obvious reasons. Sat in the memorial service that day, and I had walked past about 300 or 400 Patriot Guard riders who had ridden from all over the United States and were holding flags in the hot sun in August in Shreveport, Louisiana.
And for people that don't know, the Patriot Guard, if you ever see what looks like a huge, huge motorcycle, motorcycle gang with flags behind, you know, escorting a you know, a hearse or whatever. These guys are volunteers that come, and they are amazing, and they will come from all over, and it's an awesome sight to see these guys come and escort and create basically a parade line.
A barrier.
Right, a barrier. But
they protect the families from any protesters or anything that's going to say anything bad on that special day where they're honoring their loved one.
Absolutely.
And so I sat in that ceremony, and I watched guys walk across that were on their eighth deployment and talk about Robin Jonas, right? And I just, in that moment, said, I'm living on an island in South Beach working at Goldman Sachs. Why am I not doing anything to help? Mm-hmm. What, you know, am I living for, is it status? Is it wealth? Like, what am I living for? Like, what happened to the Peace Corps, Edward? Like, you know, where is that in my life? And it was in that moment when I realized I needed to go over and lend a hand. And I have an amazing wife who's just an angel. And she understood. We had a little 6-day-old boy, little Edward at the time.
Yep.
My son and my 2-year-old Caroline, and I think we were very lucky the Navy let me stay a couple extra days to see him be born, and he was actually born on June 6th, which is D-Day, which is very interesting. And since he had, since he's Edward as well, had kind of the same name, my wife was a little more at peace with me going, you know, but it was that, you know, it's moments like those where you're doing something and you go off and you say, okay, now I'm making money, I'm living in South Beach, da 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 da. What happened to my purpose? What happened to the higher calling? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that was when I kind of went that direction. And then I think with MIT, this was a classic Edward overcommitment thing.
Really?
And so was involved with MIT, was at the same time in the reserves. And so, you know, every other weekend, and I could have put the reserves on hold at the time, but I said, no, you got this. You can do it all at the same time.
Yep.
Right. And what happened was I couldn't. I started struggling in numerous areas of my life, marriage, family. I wasn't spending enough time at home. Mary looked at me and said, you know, you're going to be gone 7 of the next 7 weekends. Mm-hmm. And you got kids and I guess I'll take care of it. And I just felt horrible. So that was a point in my life where I realized, you know, I tend to overcommit and I need to really simplify life and focus on the things that are most important.
Which I don't think a lot of people that aren't faced with that realize what a hard realization that is. No is one of the toughest words for guys like us that are type A who think that, just bring it on. Because to not say yes, at least for me, I don't want to speak for you, but you can probably relate. To not say yes, to not take it on, is to, one, potentially miss an opportunity, which, you know, we don't want to.
You don't want to close the door.
Exactly. Right. And two, it's a sign of weakness, you know, almost. So anyway, during that process, you realize you've taken on too much, but then tactically, what did you do? How did you address the issue?
Yeah, I actually have a word for each year of my life, and I chose the word simplify. Because one of the things I had done is I would always sign up for different things, and then I would get them all done, right? But it was expense of people I loved, and it wasn't just about me anymore. And so as I got older and my kids started developing and my relationship with Mary, I realized that I needed to say no. And so I literally wrote down, I think it was Warren Buffett said, write down the top 25 goals you want to achieve in life and then X out all but 5 of them.
Wow.
And I did that.
Wow. And you know, Warren Buffett also recommends keeping a clean calendar, nothing on your calendar, so that you're ready if that opportunity, and it to get on Warren Buffett's calendar, which Bill Gates has adopted as well.
Yeah.
It's tough, man, because these guys just, Ryan Holiday says, anybody that's, you know, kind of that overachiever, a lot of people on the time, you look in there, you expect it to be a daytimer or, you know, to go back old school or whatever, that would be just full. But it's not, right?
And I have a little system that I've used called the Holy Trinity, and it's a cross with 4 different boxes. And in the first box, I have faith, family, health, right? The things that should be most important in life, right? Okay. The second box, I have Kotala and business. In the third box, I have personal development. Mm-hmm. And then the fourth box, I have what's called the Devil's Quadrant.
Oh, okay.
And that is stuff that's super, it's shiny objects, it's good idea fairy, it's stuff that I could do. It might be nice. It might even be a charity event that somebody invited me to be involved in or speak at.
Right.
And I have to say no to that because it doesn't help the core. It doesn't help the family. It doesn't help the faith or the business. And so that's really helped me to say no, is each week I go through this and I look in that, I write the things down, and I look through my calendar and I say, what is in the devil's quadrant?
Love
and
it.
I cancel it. Or I say, I can't do that because it's not part of what I need to be doing.
Yeah.
My core objectives or most valuable priorities. Right?
I like that. Okay. So, and let's talk about, so tactically you realize, so what adjustments do you make? At that point, you realize you're overcommitted. You want to simplify. That's the word for the year.
Yeah.
So what does that look like?
Yeah, I think one of them was I was involved in politics for a while. I actually had some people approach me to run for office and talk about different things like that.
Our stories, you know,
got involved in a lot of these different types of things politically, helping different candidates, getting involved, and I enjoyed that. It was something I was passionate about, and my father was involved in politics as well. And so at one point I said, okay, I'm going to do one thing. And my one thing is War Veterans Fund. So a friend of mine from Afghanistan formed this. We hit the idea back and forth together, and ultimately formed an organization called War Veterans Fund that helps men and women who are coming out of the services. We've at probably 40 a cycle, right? And we pick, you know, four or five, maybe six, that we think would die for their country, care about their country, are smart, capable, and would do an incredible job in Congress.
Wow.
And don't have either the means or the connection or the network or enough to get over the hump.
Okay.
And we back them.
Wow.
And we hold five events nationwide. We'll be holding one in Dallas next Tuesday.
Okay.
And so we helped guys like Dan Crenshaw and Mike Waltz in the very early days.
Yeah.
It's kind of VC investing for people that we think exemplify honor, courage, and commitment.
Yeah.
Right? And would be great if given the opportunity. So we have a great group of people coming next week. We have a Navy pilot, an Air Force pilot. We've got a former NFL football player for 8 years who then became a Marine, played with Pat Tillman.
Yep.
We have a Navy woman who's a captain in the Navy. So that's, I do that. That's, you know, once every 2 years we have those candidates, we do the different events. And I've really focused on helping the veteran candidates and not really getting involved in much else outside of that.
Right.
And so that's an area where I've just said no.
Right. Well, just to a plug for Dan Crenshaw. So whenever I ran for Congress, my political director, Kenneth DePew, immediately after I did not make the runoff, went to work for Dan's campaign.
No kidding.
And is now working for Dan in D.C. And he is a two-time Purple Heart recipient from Afghanistan.
Yeah.
And one of the, would like to recognize Kenneth DePew, one of the greatest human beings to ever live and one of the best assets that Dan has on his staff in
That's
D.C.
great
now.
To hear.
Yeah. So, okay, so let me ask you this from a tactical standpoint, because people that are listening to this are they're obviously going to relate. I mean, if you're listening to this podcast, you're probably a high achiever at some point. Your plate's probably pretty full as well. How would you go about, and there's two things I want to ask you, Edward. First of all, you've kind of given us the tactical approach to which, you know, the Trinity. I love that, by the way, because I've used the four quadrants also. You know, Stephen Covey has his, and I love that the way you customized yours. From the standpoint of finding that purpose of what you're going to do, what did that look like? Help the listener, because there's a lot of people out there. I mean, I struggle with this still.
Yeah.
It's like I told you before we got on, I want to use this podcast to do good things. I want it to use as a platform to get the message. Like 22 Killed, Jacob Schick, his story is the one that's running right now that I just launched, because I want people to understand that, you know, the reason why it's called 22 Killed is because on average 22 veterans take their lives every day, and the work that 22 Killed is doing is to help these veterans. How did you, and how would you advise anyone out there to sit down and figure out what it is that they can bring more purpose to their life and line their gifts and talents up in a way that can 10x their help to, you know, a cause or an organization to do good?
Very good question. So we have an internship at Katal, and we had a young man from University of Chicago, and last year we had a young man from MIT Sloan join us. And part of the internship is a discussion with them on what is your purpose? right? And it's surprising, but also not, that someone can get to be 35 years old, 40, 50 years old, and when you ask what your purpose is, they're like, what do you mean? I mean, I don't know, right?
Yeah.
And it's kind of an important thing, right? And so I went through that exercise. I similarly knew internally that I had a purpose, but it took me a while to define it. Mm. And that's something I've helped when I talk to people who are younger than me. I've had some tremendous mentors in my life. And so when I get the opportunity to pass that forward, I try to say, you know, what is your purpose? And I talk about mine, and my purpose is to glorify God through inspiring and guiding servant leaders to create radical prosperity in the world.
Wow.
Right.
Love that.
And so it's really like the way I glorify God or do what I feel like is right is by helping other leaders to help others to pay it forward. And yeah. So we look at private equity, my partner and I, at finding these great leaders who are going to lead, you know, 75 people, 100 people, 300 employees, mm-hmm. right, in a culture that's going to change the world. You know, whether it's fixing somebody's HVAC mm-hmm. That has a single unit, it's hot, it's a little old lady that's in, you know, not doing well and needs that help, or healthcare, helping someone in the home, you know, however your product or service helps others, having that leader and us kind of serving them is very important. So,
yeah.
You know, defining my own purpose, then mentoring the younger generation to say, hey, what do you think yours is? Mm-hmm. What is your skill set? Mm-hmm. What's your skill set and what's your passion? Where do those overlap?
Yeah.
And then define it. It's a tough thing to do, to put into a sentence. I struggle with it even to this day.
Yeah.
But that's something that I would recommend anyone do when you have this kind of your three buckets of life, you know, to 30, 30 to 60, and then your third phase.
Right.
And I think once you hit 30, it's, you know, you should do it earlier, but knowing what your purpose is super important, or you'll wake up one day in a 15-year career and say, why did I do that?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, one of the things that I love to do is go and I participate in this thing called Career Passport, Career Success Passport at Stephen F. Austin, where I did my undergrad. Mm-hmm. I do it at least, you know, once a semester. And inevitably, I end up becoming the mentor of a lot of these young people. And what I'm finding is that there are more and more young people these days aware of finding a purpose and finding out what they want to do with their life and acting on that instead of just the financial rewards of a job, a vocation.
You get the money and you arrive and you're like,
that's
so
it.
What do I do now?
Yeah.
And greed is incremental. You'll never have enough.
That's right.
So you finally get that number and you're like, okay, gosh, I really need more.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you've been aiming in the wrong direction.
Well, and one of the things that I found too is that when I'm focused on helping others, whether it's homeless veterans or, you know, I'm on a couple of boards in Tyler that help with it. One is young ladies that have been involved in human trafficking or have no home or whatever. They come and we're trying to restore them back into society in a healthy way, yeah. or any other thing. You start to lose sight of the material things as well as the stress that life can throw on you whenever you're helping others and you're pursuing a purpose.
When you know you're doing the right thing, you just execute and it's so much fun.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, look, Edward, I could go on and on. This is going to be a shorter conversation than I would like, but I know you've got an appointment. One question that I would like to ask real quickly, because it came up in the last lecture that I gave.
Okay.
What advice would you give to the listener out there that is seeking out mentors? Mm-hmm. How did you go about those mentors that you have in your life? Because I know a lot of mine are on this podcast.
Yeah.
I mean, I know how important they've been to me as a leader and as a professional. How would you go about doing that?
Well, I actually got some good advice from a mentor of mine, Scott Luttrell, recently about picking mentors. And, you know, I think it's important not to just pick the mentor that's been the most successful, right? Or the
yes.
one that is in the highest position. Because it's easy to do it. Say,
yep.
okay, these people have crushed it in business,
yep.
and they're going to be my mentors.
Right.
But really look for somebody who has crushed it in life.
Mm.
Who has amazing relationships with their family, who has a deep faith,
mm-hmm.
right? And have a mentor that's going to challenge you in your Christian walk,
right?
Right, and who you are as a person, not only in business. And I think that holistic approach, I know that holistic approach is better. So looking for a mentor that can solve for, that understands your family, your faith, your marriage, your relationships, and business is very important. Don't just go for the most successful. Go for the person who's going to be the best person for you holistically.
I love it. I love it. Edward, get to your appointment. Brother, thank you for this time. It has been a pleasure, and I
appreciate
you.
Thank you so much. Really enjoyed meeting you as well. So.
Likewise, brother.
Yeah. Thank you.
Hey, folks, thanks so much for listening to this episode of the Texas Titans podcast. Before you go, I do have a small ask. If you would, please go to iTunes and rate the show. I would be so grateful. Right now, we've got a 5-star rating, and I would really appreciate it if we maintain that. So please go out and do that. Also, please consider checking out my book, Push Play, Taking Your Life Off Pause. This documents my escape from corporate America into entrepreneurship, and also it helps with some practical tips and advice on how to curate the life that you want to lead that is based not just on a job or vocation, money, and material things, but actually pursuing those things that make you feel alive and make you feel as though you're living and not just maintaining life support. So please check that out. And as always, I ask you to please follow me on Instagram, Facebook, all the social medias. I'm out there. I appreciate a follow. I want your feedback. DM me, shoot me an email at jason@texttitans.com. I'm grateful for any feedback. As a matter of fact, if there's anyone that you consider a Texas Titan and want to suggest that I reach out to or make an introduction to visit with, let me know. I'm always looking for interesting people, interesting Texans that have done remarkable things. And if you've got somebody, please send them our way. I would be so grateful. Until the next episode, get out there, crush it, and thank you so much for listening to the Texas Titans podcast.